I want today to talk a little bit in terms of Akdome. We were going to, or we still are starting, at least Hilchos Memker. So I want to talk a little bit about the nature of Kinyonim. I'll be makdim with something I heard in the name of the Briskerov. I certainly can't vouch for it. There are lots of things that you hear, you don't know if they're true or not. But he reportedly told somebody that he should find any parnosa he wants, any umnas, any profession, except law. Why not law? Because in law, they teach you to think lehepech midas haTorah. They're categories, they're principles, they're not the principles of Torah. You end up with a krumakov.
Yeah. I'm good at three
lockers. Yeah. I found that countries. I found that to be the case from a
reply. I'm making no comment. Maybe you need something prophylactically to know what is outside the pale before you start, but yeah, there's something called comparative legal systems also. You can recognize that there are differences and you have to draw the distinctions. In any event, I want to talk about Kinyonim in general, and the first point is that in the common law system, there is no such thing as a Maisa Kinyon, although I know there is livery of size, so let's forget about that. But in general, other than in real estate law, their title doesn't require an overt act, symbolic or otherwise, in order to transfer title from one person to another. In the UCC, all that you need is a meeting of minds, and title will pass wherever the minds have decided that the title will pass. Their example is somebody buys a carload of wheat to be shipped from Chicago to New York, and you're around Pittsburgh at the Horseshoe Curve. There's an accident, and it's checking on me. Yeah, go ahead, Xunta.
No, because the UCC is a modern system. I mean,
it's a very modern system.
Right, so that traditionally, if we're going to talk about common law, we're going to talk about a bill of sale, and the bill of sale passes title.
Bill of sale passes title because they think that the shtar represents a meeting of minds. But there never was a requirement for any overt act to affect the sale. Whenever the parties want to
sell. Tell me how to, because you know, it's hard for me to keep quiet. So tell me I should just keep quiet until the end or something. Because
keep quiet until the end.
Okay, thank you, please. Okay, because I don't, some of these concepts
I have comments
on. Don't forget, before this whole meeting of the minds, which is modern.
Yeah.
Discussions of policy of law, which I know the law schools, they're all into them. Reality is that the old English common law system is very formalistic. Seals are like absolutely not.
Oh, yes, right. Absolutely.
But they weren't formalism, which isn't so much about meeting of minds, it's about let's get the document, let's formalize it. And if you don't have a seal, you could have a meeting of minds, but you don't have a seal, you don't have a transaction. So I don't know what that means.
It's certainly what they're teaching in law school today.
What?
It's certainly what they're teaching in law school today.
Meeting of the minds, but the reality is that if we go back to the 19th century, forget about meeting of the minds. If you don't have your seal, then you don't have a deal.
That's because you had technical legal requirements in order to be able to enforce the contract. But in terms of if the parties were to acknowledge the facts, the Maisa Kinyon certainly wasn't required. The whole statute of frauds came in order to not so much to create the need for a contract, which remember before the statute of frauds you didn't even need that. Things had to be put into a writing only to avoid chancery. But as far as the theoretical system was concerned, it wasn't necessary. And that was some kind of superimposed in order to create the parameters for litigation so that people wouldn't lie. But in terms of theoretical structure, I don't think the theoretical structure then was much different than it is now. But either way.
It's interesting. Shtikun is not good to go down.
No, it's not.
I'm going to keep quiet now, okay?
Okay.
Next.
Okay. And again, today, the first lecture in property is that property is a bundle of rights. And you don't talk about ownership of anything other than a right to whatever it is that you're talking about. And to all intents and purposes, there's nothing other than the right. There's nothing concrete. There's nothing reified. It's like the phenomenology, Berkeley. There is no matter exists. All that you have are phenomena of one kind or another. And I won't even talk about hints of such things in the Tanya, etc., etc. But it's enoid malvade. I'm not interested in that, but right now, anyway. But basically, in halacha, you start with the principle of a chaymer hiyuli, as I would call it. You have a basic substratum, and that's property. Property is a chefze. It exists. Now we can talk about other things. You can talk about who has the kinyan to the property, who has title to the property, etc., etc. And if you talk about kinyan, the kinyan remembers a homonym. Kinyan first means title, and then it's the maisa kinyan, the way to transfer property from one person to another. The notion of property as not the maisa kinyan, but the notion of kinyan for itself is the title that you have to the heftze. So if you now talk about the person's individual relationship to his property, you're talking about property not as a bundle of rights, but property as the heftze and the proprietor as the gavra. And the question now is, what is the relationship between the heftz and the gavra? And that's what kinyonim are all about. Kinyonim create a relationship between the person and the property itself, not between rights. Those aren't in the property. Those are things that a person has. But there is the heftz, which gives rise to these things that can become property interests. And those are transferred by means of a kinyan of one sort or another. And obviously, you need gemiras das and smichus das, but it's taken for granted that you need a maisa kinyan as well. And in the yeshivas, there was a kind of a chakira. What's a kinyan? Is one of three possibilities. The kinyan is either a evidentiary, it's a simon, it's a sign that there was proper gemiras das, or it's generative, it creates the gemiras das. Nobody has gemiras das or smichus das unless there's a kinyan. Or the third possibility, it's a gzeres hakosov, and you just need it because the Torah says you need it. And which of the three is correct doesn't make terribly much difference, at least for our purposes. And I probably won't get today to the point of talking about transfer of title in very, very limited cases without a maisa kinyan. So if you can have that without a maisa kinyan, it seems to me that there's you certainly can't call it gzeres hakosov. But that comes as something of a chidush, and all the sources that talk about it present it as a chidush, that you know what? You can have a transfer, you can have something passing from one person to another without a maisa kinyan, because presumption is that the maisa kinyan is a sine qua non. Now, I want to talk about what this maisa kinyan is or how we should look at this maisa kinyan. But basically, I have a series, I won't call them kashas, I have a series of problems or things I think have to be understood. The first of those is why in halacha you can't convey a davar shalai bo leilam. In other systems, you can convey your rights to the estate of your maiden aunt who has named you a beneficiary in her will. It's called the future interest. We call it the davar shalai bo leilam, and there's no way in the world that I can transfer a davar shalai bo leilam. The question is, why? You also can't assign title to a davar she'ein bo mamish. The example that you find in the Acharonim is a Teves Hanoah. I can have a Teves Hanoah, whether it is moment or isn't moment, doesn't make any difference for this Shaila. I can't give it to somebody else. And this schus of a mitzvah, I can't sell. A father who has a baby can't sell the right to be mal the child. Whether he does it or he doesn't do it is a separate issue. But he can't sell it so that person has received something of value. Yeah?
In terms of selling your rights, what about Dekan Le Perosov?
I want to talk about that too. It's also one of my things. Now, again, I'm not trying to present one notion that will satisfy every sheet in Rishonim. For example, with regard to Dovr Shleibo Lo Ilom, I can give you a whole list of even Rishonim, allegedly even the Tshuvas HaRosh. Problem is it the Rosh or isn't it the Rosh, who maintained that the chesaron of a Dovr Shleibo Lo Ilom is only a chesaron of Smichus Das, and that if you will have Smichus Das, you can sell a Dovr Shleibo Lo Ilom. Problem is, you don't ordinarily have Smichus Das. The Orach Chaim in Chumash says the same concept. He explains the same notion with regard to the sale of the Bechira by Esav to Yaakov. It's a Dovr Shleibo Lo Ilom. How does it work? He shavali. With a Shvua, there's Gemiras Das. And you have, as allegedly, the Rosh saying, if it wasn't the Rosh, it was somebody else in the Tkufas Rishonim, that if you have a Dovr Shleibo Lo Ilom, which you sell together with the Shvua, not to be Chazer, that becomes a valid sale. And it's certainly without a Maisakinian, or better, I don't know. The usual theory is that you can't sell a Dovr Shleibo Ilom, not because there's no Gemiras Das, but that somehow or other it's a Chsaron in the Maisakinian, and that's what I'm going to try to explain. Try to enumerate them, not necessarily in any particular order, but there's a Dvar Avram who talks about Hefker Besdin, and he thinks that even though Hefker Besdin can be a Deraisa, but there can't be a Hefker Besdin on a Nichsei Kotten. Even though cotton can own property, either inherited or tasacheres makne, but a cotton can't be makne, and therefore there's no hefker bezin. He can't be mafker, and not only can't he be mafker, but bezin can't be mafker his nechosim. I don't quite understand why yet, but I understand each one of these things could be explained in one way or another. And there's a Chuvus Rebbe Tivager who talks about kinyan drabonon mahani leili deraisa, which is itself a tumul in achreinim, and he proceeds to say that even if hefker bezin can be mafker title, but midoraisa, there can't be such a thing as hefker bezdin to vest title. Now, there are achreinim, particularly Rebbe Chonin, who says it's totally in the two derivations in Ashulayach. I think Rebbe Geir would have said that there you're dealing with the rabbonon, you're not dealing with deraisas, it's not smachta, that everybody knows that bezdin can be mafker, but bezdin can't vest title. Okay. That's a little thing, little prat that needs some kind of explanation. Sure.
So bezin can't be mafker, but they can't best title. So what's this? Where it sounds like limbo. Where does that property end up then?
Trabonos. So all they're talking about terraces. So the trabonos. There is such a possibility, you know, that can if you maintain. I see what you mean. You mean the Gemara? Yeah. If Besdin can't vest title, then all the Besdin can do is be mafker, whatever it is, a mafker, and whoever's there can get title. So, for example, if you have Afkino Rabban LeKedushim, which is, you know, the paradigm for all the problems, mm-hmm. the Besdin is mafker the Tabas Kedushim, but it still belongs to the Kala. She was a Chemina Hefker, but she didn't get it from the Baal. She's not in the Kodeshes. But I can't go and seize her ring. She was there first. So she was a Chemina Hefker. That's, you know, if the Bezdin doesn't have the power to directly vest, then all they're doing is being Mafker, and you come and take it. You can have cases in which that doesn't happen, and then you have whatever it is they talk about. The other problem, which I think is a little bit more a more serious problem, and that is the question of how there can be a shibud nechosim that travels with the land. Now, an ordinary shibud nechosim I have no problems with. Reuven borrows money from Shimon. Shimon owns a field. Reuven has a shibud in the field. He's got a lien against the property. Therefore, when Shimon sells the field to Levi, he sells it subject to the lien. It's as if Reuven has a kind of a property interest that is senior to the property interest of Shimon and hence of Levi. Shimon bought it subject to the right of execution to recover for non-payment of loan, and he can't sell more than that for Levi. So Levi can't get more than Shimon had. And as far as Shimon is concerned, it's like a shiur. It's a reservation or an exclusion of one kind or another in the sale. My problem is, I have no problem how you can collect from Shimon. I have no problem how, if Shimon still owns the property, you can collect from him. That's what Shiva is all about. But I do have a problem with regard to Shimon, who goes out and buys the field after he borrowed the money. When he borrowed the money, there was a Shibud HaGuf, and the Shibud HaGuf attaches to the property. My problem is that if Shimon goes out and buys the field, how can Reuven collect from him? As long as Reuven still owns the field, I don't have a real problem. Shimon owns the field, and Nichsed Bar Inishar Voinlai, I can act against you, act against your property. But what prevents Shimon from selling that field to Levi, and what prevents Levi from getting unencumbered title? How can Reuven go to Levi to reclaim a piece of property, or to seize a piece of property that wasn't owned by Shimon at the time that the halva was extended? Now, I know you can explain it, but I want to see if there's one theory that can explain everything. I also want to know why Momen Shein Lem Tovim, I should have spoken about that before also, I suppose. You can't sell Momen Shein Lem Tovim, obviously. If you can't sell a Dover Shein B'Mamish, you also can't sell Momen Shein Lem Tovim. And I know why any individual Kohen or Levi can't go and seize Truma or Meiser, because Tevis Hanoa belongs to the Bailim, and he doesn't have any individual proprietary interest. But Halacha knows all about class actions, in a limited sense, where you have two individuals whose claim is doubtful, but it's a valid claim for one of the two, and there are multiple cases in Halacha. Neither one of them can be a Teveyim Besdin, because the Nitva, the defendant, will be mad and say, I don't know if it's you, maybe it's the other one. But if they both come together and they say, my mother shot, give it to me, between them they'll be able to collect, they'll be able to get it between them. So all they need is a harshot, one person to go to Besdin, representing both of them, and it's a done deal. There is no such thing with Momen Shein Lem Tovim. I know it's a little bit difficult, but we'll get every kohen in the world to sign a shtar harshot. And now the Mursha will want to go and seize the Truma. And he's seizing it on behalf of all these people who gave him authority to seize. What they do with it, they'll do afterwards. But the Baal HaTruma has every right to say, I'm sorry, it's Momen Shein Lem Tovim. You can't get it in Besdin. I want to know why. Why can't you get it in Besdin? These people have, it's Ein Lem Tovim, but somebody has a right to the Truma. So why can't they combine and exercise their right? Again, Rabbi Harari wanted to know about Dekel Lepe Reisov. I know that there are differences between Dekel Lepe Reisov and Peres Dekel. Peres Dekel is a Dover Shleib Olaylam. And Dekel Lepe Reisov is also a Dover Shleib Olaylam. The Dekel is here, but the Peres aren't here. How do I sell the Dekel Lepe Reisov? I didn't sell you the Dekel. I sold you the Dekel Lepe Reisov. I sold you the Dekel for things that aren't here. I call that a Dover Shleib Olaylam. What's happening here? The other point is that you have things called kinyone geneve. Now, kinyone geneve, I regard as a property interest. In fact, kinyone geneve are a property interest. I have chatas nurim, I've taught property. And, you know, the standard lecture is that property is a bundle of rights. And mine was that it also includes negative rights. Negative rights of property. Want the simplest negative right? Rockefeller doesn't sleep well at night. I sleep like a baby. He has the right not to sleep at night. Marvin Chosin Marbadaika. I have no right not to sleep at night. The fear of losing property keeps him awake. The right to sustain a loss is something which is a concomitant of all other property rights. It's a negative right. Who suffers the loss? The proprietor. If he's not a proprietor, he has nothing to lose. Now that he's a proprietor, he can lose property as well. So you'll ask me, it's so obvious, what's the point of saying all of this? That is the essence of Kinyani Geneva, Kinyani Shmira. The essence of Kinyani Geneva is to be Chayef Reinsing. The Balabais, the proprietor, is Chayef Reinsing. There's an act of God, it's destroyed. Who suffers the loss? He suffers the loss. He has no claim against anybody else because he's got the sole right to suffer the loss. The ganev takes the property and acquire kinyoni geneve. He's chayef reinsin also. Why is he chayef reinsin? Because he got some property rights. He got at least this right, which I call a negative right. And the same is true for chiyuv shmira. That, I think, is pretty obvious. My little problem is that if you look at the kinyonim in Geneva and kinyonim in Shmira, they're virtually the exact parallel as kinyonim that you use to transfer from one person to another. What are we doing here? What's happening here? Why do you need a kinyon Geneva? And why do you need a kinyon Shmira? And what is it designed to accomplish? So let me try to explain all of this. I think that Kinyan sub 1, which means title, not the Maisa Kinyan, we'll talk about that later, that's Kinyan sub 2. Kinyan meaning title, a proprietary interest, proprietorship. There aren't even words in legalese to describe what I'm talking about. Bailus, whatever this is the functional equivalent of Ishus. Ishus is difficult to understand. Relationships don't exist in the real world. There are two walls in this room. One is a right wall and one is the left wall. The terms right and left are used to describe a relationship between the walls. There is no such thing called rightness. It doesn't exist. If you don't have a left, you don't have a right. The right can't exist without a left. When you talk about any kind of a relationship, you're talking about a relationship between two individuals. If one individual isn't here, there can't be a relationship. And the relationship isn't something superimposed upon the two people. The two people are here, and they now may be in the relationship of parent to child, brother to sister, what have you, but they're just two people. And where is this relationship? There's no such thing. At least not in the physical universe, maybe in some other universe. There is something called matrimony. Matrimony is a relationship between a male and a female. At least that's traditional matrimony. You have to have a male and a female, and they enter into a contract, and as a result of the contract, you've got something called the state of matrimony. That's all it sounds like. It's a relation, but there is nothing beyond that. So the Briska Rav, Zecharia Levracha, said that there is something beyond that. He called it, I don't know what he called it, I'll call it Ishus. Ishus exists, and Ishus isn't simply a Chosna and a Kala who got together. It's something that comes on top of the Chosna and the Kala. Where did the Briska Rav say it? He said it in terms of problems in Rishonim. Number one, the Rosh Hashkasha, how does Yankiv marry to Achoyes? He's keeping call of Terakula, and forget about the Terah truths in Rishonim. The Brisker Rav had a very simple answer. And he had a second kasha. His kasha was Birkas Erisin. Asher kishon b'sos zvon al-roi, zvoslan sarusa, zvitalon sarusa lonu, ayde chupo v'kidushin. I can understand. See, this is Rabbon at least. He to learn us in the Suez. That's what this is all about. What's an erva got to do with this? This isn't an erva. He wouldn't be under the chuppah if it were an erva. Kedushin aren't teifis in aroyas. And at kedushin, you're making a bracha with a brichas hamitzvahs, a brichas haidah, tas, simnalef, yerdeya. I don't care. Both make any difference what the status of the bracha is. But how can there be a bracha on a relationship in which kedushin aren't teifis when you're talking about a relationship where kedushin are teifis? So the Brisker Rav says that the brocha shem says one of al arroyos is a brocha, and I suspect it's easiest to understand when we're dealing with the birkas hidayah. It's a dua to the Ribbono Shleilam for having created issues, and there was no issues before Har Sinai, before there was a bulas baal for Bnei Noach. The Ribbono Shleilam created issues in addition to the mitzvah of Kikach Yishisho. Kikach Yishisho is nice, but, and then what happens? So you have to have, the whole Chavoyisa. There's now issues which the Ribbono Shleilam created. You ask me, where does it exist? It's got reality, ontological reality. It's metaphysical. And it descends magically from Nina Shemaim, when the Chosin gives the Kala a ring and says, Harem Kadeshusli creates the issues. It creates this, but Tzachefza didn't exist until Har Sinai, and now my separations wasn't finished until Har Sinai. A physical world he created. He may even have created Shady Bein Hashemoshes, or who knows what. But Ishus he didn't create until Har Sinai. And then he gave a Bosar V'dom, as long as he's a Jew, he gave him the Koyach to create or to draw down this Ishus. And on every new Erusin, that's what Erusin is designed to do. It's designed to create this metaphysical state of issues. So issues is not a relationship. It's something, it's a penumbra of some kind. It's superimposed on the relationship, or if you like, the relationship flows from this metaphysical entity.
Is
a Kenyan Yisr, but you're now making issues into nothing more than a kinyan, the kinyan that the Baal has in the wife. Now, that itself is hard to understand. The Baal doesn't have a kinyan in the wife. They're not kishvuyei tachas baalein, says the Rambam. Yes, there's shibudim that he has, and the woman has shibudim on the husband too. She certainly doesn't have a kinyan in the husband. And whatever shibudim she has certainly don't flow from her kinyan iser. The shibudim, yeah, it's a pil yetzer. When you have issues, all these things come. Once there's issues, the rest comes easily. If you don't have issues, it's hard to explain all these other things. But once you accept the notion that there is a metaphysical universe in which issues exist, and that this issues is manifest in the physical universe, in every chuppah v'kiddushin, everything flows therefrom. Now, I don't want to belabor it, and I certainly don't need it. And incidentally, whatever I'm saying, not everything, but most of it is not in Mesivas Halacha and not in contemporary Halacha problems, but it's the philosophical quest. It's the metaphysics of property, that chapter. I think that Ishus is the best example of the kind of metaphysical thing that I'm talking about. And I didn't put that there, but I did invoke the unhallowed name of Plato, Plato's theory of ideas, and his myth of the cave. If you don't know about it, Ashrei Chelkecha, but this is very Platonic. Plato thinks that everything that exists in this world is a mirror of things that exist in some other world. There's the idea with a capital I, and all of this is, these are shadows, and he's got the moshul of the shadow, but it's only a reflection of what's up there. Forget about Plato. As far as issues is concerned, this is exactly what the Brisker Rav meant. And you don't have to know Plato to be able to say it. The Ribbono Shel Olam created issues that I've seen that didn't exist before. And it's metaphysical. And he gave man the koyach to bring down these koyches elyonim, this issues that exists up there, and it becomes reified, it becomes concretized, if you can talk about concretizing metaphysics. It becomes concretized in every chuppah and kiddushin. That's what it's all about. But why you have to start with this as the notion? You've got to reify things that are basically metaphysical. And that's not my chiddush. That's the Brisk Rav, and I don't think it's a chiddush. I think that bailus is a proprietary interest. The notion of Kenyan sub one is precisely the same idea. The old Chakira, is there Lisigzel because you own the property, or do you own property because it's Lisigzel? Attributed to Reb Shimon. If I'm right, it's a Dover Poshet. And I'll explain more later. But you have to have a property interest first before you can have a Lisigzel. Because if your relationship with your property is simply relational, then it could very well be the case that you have a property interest because there says nobody else has the property interest. So you remove all of the others and you're left with what's there. Like the Rishonim say about Kiddushin, she says, it's Atzmak HaHefker, and the male of the Chosin gets it. If you talk about Kinyonim that way, you can say, sure, the Torah Asered, nobody else can use this. I'm the only one who can use it, so the male, it's mine. That's a relational type of analysis of property, and it's what I would have called an interest type theory. Call it a bundle of interest. Nobody else has interest. I have it. If I'm right, then there couldn't be a Lisigzel unless there was a bailus. What is bailus? Bailus is a metaphysical relationship between, I shouldn't say the word relationship, it is a metaphysical context which creates the relationship between the proprietor and the property. The property becomes endowed with this bailus, the same way that a union, becomes endowed with issues. Everything comes with bailus attached to it in one way or another, unless it's hefker. We'll talk about that in a second. But essentially, I understand bailus in a manner parallel to a way I conceive of issues, and I don't think I made it up for issues. I think that's what the Brisk Rav said about issues. And bailus is exactly the same thing. When the Rebbe Yishlan and the Noach had this also, it's not the Sinai. There is such a thing as kinyonim, sub one, meaning property interest, and the property interest is something that connects the individual to the property, and that's called bailus. Now, at this point, I need a kind of a moshul. One moshul is that you can take a piece of property, the police tell you to do it. You get one of these electric pencils or something, and you make simonim in the back, so if it's stolen, you can get it back. You stamp it onto the property. You stamp your proprietary notice on the property, and that tells all and sundry that it belongs to you. I think that you don't need the electric pencil to do this, your electric pen. I think that you can use a different kind of a moshul. My moshul, and I can talk about it as if it's real, and if it's not real, so it's my little myth. My moshul is that everything that is a Dover Sheyesh Beg Mamish, and we have a Chaymer Hiyuli, there is a substratum. These interests adhere in something which is concrete. They couldn't exist in something which isn't concrete. What is concrete comes in a package with a tentacle. When the Eberster created the world, he created things and he gave everything, every apple, every orange, every tree, every rock, he gave it a little tentacle which is attached to the rock. And the other, it's got a sucker that attaches it to the rock. And the other side is another sucker. And anybody can come and pick up the sucker and attach the sucker to his shoulder, and he becomes the Baili. That's called making a kinyan. How do you attach something which is hefker to yourself? You make the appropriate kinyan, hagbah, mashiach, whatever it is. The maisa kinyan creates the relationship between the individual and the property, and it's not just a, quote, relation, close quote. It is an ontological relation because you are now creating this notion of property or the institution of property, which flows from the thing itself to the proprietor. And it's real, it's concrete. You can't see it, you can't touch it, you can't feel it, but you have to regard it as something which is concrete. I'll give you another example, which I regard as metaphysical. No physicist would call it metaphysics, but that's because I don't think he properly understands what he's saying. In the the third grade, they gave you a piece of paper and some iron filings, and they gave you a magnet. And you put the magnet under the iron filings, and lo and behold, they arranged themselves in a horseshoe. And the teacher told you, why does this happen? Because the magnet exudes a magnetic field. The teacher might just as well have told me that there is a malach inside the magnet. He's called Malach HaMemuna al HaMagnetism, and he loves to eat iron filings, and he tries to get the iron filings, and he tries to grab them. And ordinarily they would be swallowed up by the magnet, but there's an interposition. You've got a chetzitza of a piece of paper, so it stays on top, but it's in the same pattern. Now, the Malach HaMemuna al HaMagnetism and the magnetic field are two names for the same thing. You're dealing with metaphysics. But the physicist talks about it as if it's real. And it is real. I don't say, heaven forfend, I should say that metaphysics isn't real. But you have to accept the notion that a magnetic field either doesn't exist, that it's a myth, or it's metaphysical. I don't care whether you call it a myth or you call it metaphysical. You are using reified language or the language of reification in order to explain a phenomenon. And you talk about the magnetic field as if it's real. It's not just some kind of random arrangement of iron filings and a pattern. It's because there is a magnetic field, and that's how the universe operates. I don't find it terribly surprising. I think that if the physicist denies metaphysical entities, he ought to either concede that he's talking nonsense, or that he's not talking about a magnetic field at all, and it's sloppy language. He's talking about the behavior of iron filings vis-a-vis the behavior of a certain kind of metal, but the magnetic field as a field doesn't exist. I suspect that that's what the physicist would say. And if you ask him then why you keep on talking about a magnetic field, he'll tell you it's a myth. It's convenient verbal shorthand. That's the way I convey the concept to people who don't know anything about magnetism. It is a simplified way of explaining things. The use of language in this way is an attempt to explain phenomena that otherwise you could explain only phenomenologically.
I'm getting a little lost here. So my knowledge of physics is a little weak. Let's talk about all the different bonding systems, none of which you can see, but which those scientists will speak about, like covalent bonding and hydrogen, all those kind of different forms of bonding between electrons, etc. To my mind, and maybe even semantically, maybe essentially, that's not metaphysics. That's not myth.
I first have to ask you what you mean by bonding.
Different kinds of forces that are again, not my field, not my expertise, but there's a number of different forces that play between electrons and
you're talking about what I would call the problem of causality.
We've got a number of different types of forces that are applied.
You start talking about forces, you're talking my language. When you're talking about forces, and you talk about forces as the force be with you, and this force is what some people...
Not that kind of force.
It's Bezer Anpin. It's that kind of force.
What?
Bezer Anpin. A minuscule little force. Once you talk about force, you are reifying it. You're talking metaphysics. When you limit yourself to making predictions about how certain atoms, electrons, what have you, are going to behave in each other's presence, so you're a novi. You're predicting future events, but you're a novi who's telling me that this is regular, and at that point becomes the law of nature, which is nes nister. It's going to happen. Why it's going to happen, I can't tell you. That's why I said I thought you were talking about causality.
Well,
but once you use the language of force, you're using what I call metaphysical language.
Okay, so I'm confused. Basically, because I need to understand, otherwise I'm not going to be able to follow you, because what you're describing as metaphysics, to my mind, is physics. In other words, and a physicist is not a physicist, he's a metaphysicist, but we're really talking,
You're right. I agree with
in
you.
In your language.
Yes.
There's no physicist who's going to agree with you and say, I'm a metaphysicist.
Oh, yes. Well, once he understands what I'm saying, I think he has to agree with me or turn around and say, I am using the language of mythology. I don't really mean what I'm saying, and I'm just using this because it's convenient and it helps, it's pedagogically correct because it helps me get the idea across to other people.
Okay, so
nothing more than that.
Can you just very, very briefly explain to me what I need to understand so I understand the language you're using, which I'm used to understanding in the physical realm? To my mind, metaphysical. Or
talk about gravity. I think gravity. Oh, sorry, not gravity. I'm sorry, magnetism.
Let's take magnetism. I don't tend to. But let's talk about gravity. Simple.
No, gravity. I don't.
Well,
if you talk about a gravitational force,
okay,
you're talking metaphysical language. But it's very easy to forego language of gravitational force and make predictive statements about how objects possessing mass are going to accelerate. And then you don't have to talk about the force of gravity. Once you're asking for an explanation of why does this happen, so you do one of two things. Either you shrug your shoulders and say, how do I know? Or you tell me there's a gravitational force that does this, mm-hmm, which is another confession of ignorance. Because you have no idea what a gravitational force is. It's metaphysics. Unless you tell me that it's got a real existence. It's the Malach HaMamuna ala gravity that does all of this. And every time you have these bodies, he intervenes and he causes these things to happen. If you talk about gravitational force, you believe that there is such a thing as a gravitational force, over and above the phenomenon that takes place when you have two bodies that come into some kind of contact with one another, you're talking about things that aren't physics anymore. You're talking about things that are metaphysics.
Why are they meta?
Because the physicist can't produce the gravitational force. He can't produce the magnetic field. He can only tell me that I have evidence of its existence. And when you talk about physical evidence of the existence of non-physical things, you're talking about physical evidence for metaphysical, or the existence, ontological existence, of metaphysical evidence.
Is that the case? I mean, because, for example, physicists, someone who wraps a lot of wire around a coil or something like that and runs the electric field through the coil is going to create a magnetic force that produces it.
So,
right? So there you have it. You said someone's produced a magnetic field.
Oh! You told me how to... Well, you did one of two things. Either you did certain things with molecules,
right,
cause and effect,
right,
or you know how to harness the lumis eluinim. You create malachim. Man can create malachim. Chachme Kabbalah say it all the time, don't they? So, I mean, it's the same kind of language. And my point is really very simple. My point is that we use language to reify things because it's pedagogically wise. And that's one way of saying it. Or the other way of saying it, that we're dealing with metaphysical entities. And I think that just as in the third grade, I think it's pedagogically wise to talk about magnetic fields, I think it's wise to talk about Bailus and Kinyonim in precisely the same way. Now, why do I think it's wise? Because it explains all the problems I started with. Once I think about it this way, I can explain all of those categories of halacha in a way that makes sense, because otherwise it looks like a bunch of things strung together and I can't make head or tail out of it. Kabbalah in the Kabbalah and halacha in the Sinai. But how do I get a unifying theory of property that explains all of these different things that I think need some kind of unified explanation? Okay, let me try. Go weiter. So again, in the simple sense and the simple kinyonim, it's easy. When I start out with something which is hefker, I take the tentacle and attach it to myself. If I want to declare something res nullius, I take the tentacle off my shoulder, I throw it to the ground, and you can come pick it up. When I want to transfer title from one person to another. I take the tentacle from my shoulder and I put it on somebody else's shoulder. That's called a kinyan. And of course the kinyan needs gemiras das and smichus das, because otherwise it doesn't work. Otherwise it's an error and I can claim it back. I get it right back. I may have tried to push the tentacles around, but it doesn't make any difference. I can always get them back. But once I have done this, I have created a new relationship called bailus between the individual and his property. Now, the first thing that I have as a result of all of this, I understand perfectly why I can't transfer title to a Dover Shleibo Leilam. I can't give away what I don't have because I don't have any tentacles attached to me. How can I take the tentacle from my shoulder and give it to somebody else if it's not attached to my shoulder? I have a future interest, but I can only convey something which is concrete or meta-concrete. It's concrete in the metaphysical world. You want my little, another little moshel for this? There was a German case going back sometime in the 20s. Somebody had taken, everybody has an electric meter. This guy took his electrical wiring and connected to his neighbor's meter. And he gets called into court on a charge of theft. And the prosecution loses because the judge takes out the German statute, civil law. They takes out the German statute governing theft, and it talks about the theft of a Sache in German, like a Sach. He says electricity is not a Sach. He says it's not a Sache. What it is, I don't know yet. But it's not a thing. You didn't steal a thing. So you're not guilty of theft. Because there's no property. There's property only with a thing. What the judge was saying, exactly what I'm saying, only he was talking about the statute. I'm talking about property. He's talking about zache. I don't need the word zache in the statute. Property, by definition, is a thing. Why? Because I have to have something that I can attach the tentacles to. What I can't attach a tentacle to is not subject to proprietary interest. That explains the Dover Shleibolololom. Explains a Dover Shein B'mamish. Tevis Hanoah is not a property interest. There's nothing here. A mitzvah. I can't sell a mitzvah because I can't get my tentacles into the mitzvah. It's not concrete. The tentacles don't attach to them. If you, to me, l'shitosi at least, I don't think there's such a thing as copyright in halacha. I know that the Sheol Meshi thinks there is. But there can't be a property right in intellectual property, you'll forgive me. There can't be a property right in intellectual property in halacha because it's overshamed by mamish. I can't get my tentacles in it. What's an idea? And it's ephemeral. The property is metaphysical, but it's a metaphysical aspect of something physical. There's no metaphysical property up there.
I just have to. Yeah. Okay, it's not that one. That is my right. That's okay. But just. So you can clarify your example for me. I mean, there's no copyright ideas. There's copyright in expression, but maybe
no copyright expression either.
Like, that's why I need to clarify.
So yeah, because the expression is not concrete.
So it's for example, I write whatever a safer, and then you reprint it.
Right. You have bailus in the piece of paper that you wrote,
but not bailus in expression.
No, the expression is what. It's hevel p.m. You know, it's words, mere words.
Okay, let me ask you quickly.
Tentacles can't attach to mere words.
Okay. Tentacles can't attach. So, and maybe in common law there is no such thing. That's why they had to come up with statutory right of copyright. Right? Or
is that, no, there is a common law right. Of course there's a common law right.
There's not a common law.
Till you publish.
Statute of Anne.
Till you publish. Publishes delivery to the public domain. Yeah. And you have to have protection for somebody who has already published, because in common law, the act of publication would have made it hefker. So now you have to protect it by statute. But if you haven't published, you're protected in common law.
How?
I don't know how. Because it's a property interest.
No.
If I haven't.
But I won't have a discussion. But let me ask you about. Trademark and Hasag as a rule.
We're not talking about copyright today. My biggest piece of evidence that I have to be right is why in the world did everybody bother putting a little notice on every sefer that was printed, Yisur Hasogas Gvul Yodua, and therefore we're announcing a cherem against anybody that will reprint within a specified period of time. There was no protection halacha, so you had to find a way of generating protection. The only way to generate protection was, we didn't have a parliament to pass legislation, but you invoke the power of cherem. And now the question is, and if it's dealing with mishpatei hacherem, so let's go and see. Does it have to be baal peh? Can you have a cherem b'ksav? Who gave you the power to prevent printing this in Ashkash? You can, you're rov in the town, maybe you can issue a cheirim for the town. But you can't give a cheirim in Frankfurt and expect it to be valid in Dierenforth was where Herr Wolf went and pirated the, their mafzerin, the Rödelheim. Reidelheim. And this is now a machlekes tachsam sefer, and the Rebbe the process Mordechai, and you can see the tshuva is back and forth. And the tachsam sefer says, "Ah, of course it's a cherem, and he has no right to make a cherem in Dierenforth, but it's a cherem hakadmonim that's only triggered by the local rule." I don't know who these Kadmonim were. It didn't make sense before the printing press. And from Gutenberg until Sam Slafer is a matter of less than 400 years. But it's like the Cherem HaShiduchim. Where's the, you write the Haknas leads to the Cherem, the Cherem leads to the Haknas Nitzayim. Who made that Cherem? Nobody knows who made that Cherem. It's got to be Cherem HaKadmonim. So the Cherem of printing a Sefer, it's a Cherem HaKadmonim. I'm not interested in whether he was right or whether he was wrong. I'm interested that he recognized there was a problem. If you have rights to intellectual property, then it's called Geneva. Forget about Hasogas Gvul. I don't know why. Hasogas Gvul protects a publisher. And it protects a publisher because you can't be Yerid, L'teichayo, v'chule, v'chule. It doesn't protect an author. An author has no rights. The publisher has rights. That's because you're interfering with his earning a living or whatever you're doing with the publisher, but not something to do with the author. The author's got to, he wants a property interest, whether or not he's going to use it for Parnassa. That's why I think that this explains one of the things that begs explanation is, you know, why isn't there such a thing as copyright in halacha? And I'm starting with the conclusion. I think there isn't. So I have to explain why there isn't. And I think that with the exception of the Sholem Yeshiv, I can't find anybody who thinks there is. You know, they talk as if there is, et cetera, et cetera. But nobody has ever spelled it out or told me why. I don't think it exists. I don't think it can exist.
What about, I use trademark, but that's not the best way to think about it. What about, in the United States, called unfair competition, in English, common law, passing off, creating confusion. I create a whole sense of these are Nemet stores, and everyone relies on them. And someone says, you know what, great, he's got a great business because everyone identifies the stores as green and white.
So what? Tell me which Simon in Chayshim Mishpat I looked to find.
I don't know. I'm asking.
I don't think it's there.
There's no law. In other words, I open next door, I use the same trade dress, et cetera, et cetera, and there's no
class.
Uh huh.
Opening next door.
No, it's Hasogas Gvul.
Right.
So he's talking about using across town, using the same name.
But within the same area, the people, where reputations will get confused. So it doesn't only across town if everyone kind of gets confused.
So they get confused. So they get confused. That will require some kind of legislative remedy. You know, we have the power of Takana. At least in theory. We just don't have the people to make takanas anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You're telling me that there is a societal need for it.
Common law, for example, a common law would appear to recognize a property interest in the brand, goodwill, trade dress, sense of what a person creates in terms of that. And it's intangible, obviously. Okay.
Very intangible. That's why it can't be Lasigzel. It can't be Lasigzel if it's intangible. It can't be Gezel. And whatever else it is, we'll talk about. I'm not sure what else it is. But Gesla certainly is. I'll give you another example. What happened after this decision in Germany? So the legislature went out, they passed a new law. So you can have Gesla on electricity also. So then 10, 15 years later, there was somebody who used a slug in a coin telephone. And the telephone company was charging him with theft. and they lost because he didn't steal anything. Of course he didn't steal anything. The court was absolutely right. They forget there was a matter of statute, statutory interpretation. The language they used wasn't broad enough to include Gezel of Tashmishim. They should have kind of worded it differently if they wanted to. But you'll come to ask me whether a person has used a slug in the telephone, does the telephone company have a right to Besdin to say, you stole from me? I would sort of shrug my shoulders and say, he's a shoshli midas. He's Nikro Goslin, but I'm not sure I can get back the value of a telephone call from him. He may be Nikro Goslin. It's theft of Tashmishim. Theft of Tashmishim isn't the theft of the thing itself. You can't call this, he does have Kinyan Gzeila, basically. And he won't be liable for any damage which occurs to the telephone. And Ganav's Mechui, for instance, afterwards, this guy's not going to be Mechui for anything, even if he managed to get the Tashmish of the telephone. So if the notion is correct, then it seems to me that, of course, you can transfer certain property interests. When you call property a bundle of interests, you're telling me I can sell the usufruct to payers. You can tell me I can sell mineral rights, and I don't necessarily have to sell the underlying fee, v'hule, v'hule. But it tells me that the whatever I am selling is because the tentacles have tendrils. They can be divided. It's one, it's like tzitzis. You can take out the little strands and you can transfer each one of those strands separately. And you will transfer that part which attaches to that property interest. The difference between Peres Dekel and Dekel of Peres, I understand very well. There is, again, I don't like to use philosophical language, it's the Aristotelian entelechy, the notion that there is something in the acorn that becomes the oak, a little inside it, microscopic. But there's a koyach in the acorn, which is concrete, it's physical. And that's what I'm selling you. It attaches to something physical as distinct from Dekel, from Peres Dekel. I didn't give you anything in the Dekel, I only gave it to you when it came. When I give you the Dekel of Peresov, I am giving you not the Dekel. I'm giving you something in the Dekel, that which gives rise later to the Peres of the Dekel. And if you want to know why there's no class action, as I call it, for Trumas and Maestras, it's because nobody has a tentacle into the Truma or the Maestra. When I come and I say, you stole something from me, I come and I say, look, there's a tentacle here. You went and you stole one of the tentacles and attached it to yourself, and you got Kinyoni Geneva. Here the Bala Bos has the tentacles. I have absolutely nothing. What makes me the Bailim to come in and claim? When two people come into Bezin and say, you borrowed from Reuven or Shimon. We have two Reuven and Shimon Birachas. And when each one claims, the Malva, the Leiva says it was the other guy. And when they come together and say, Monashah, give it to one of us, the situation is, one of us has come with a valid claim. And if Bezin had metaphysical spectacles that could see the tentacles of Eved Levelish Malva, they would know immediately which one. Is it Reuven or Shimon? The problem is they can't see. But when they come together, Bezin knows that between them, they've got the tentacles. And so therefore, you can have a class action. Reuven and Shimon of the class. When you deal with Trumas and Maestras, nobody has any proprietary interest. Nobody's got a tentacle. There's nothing, nobody there to claim. Nobody can present such a claim under those circumstances. So, and if you need, I didn't even talk about it, but you want to know why there can't be wills in Halacha, there are no wills in Halacha. And if there are wills, it's because they aren't wills. There's something else. Either it's an inter vivos gift, or you created a shibud michaim, whatever you did. Once the person is no longer alive, the tentacles have left. They're not there. And he doesn't want to separate the tentacles till after he dies. After he dies, he has no tentacles. It's the opposite of the original Eilam. They disappear. They exit the Eilam. So it's impossible to do this, which means that, again, I'm not going to talk about we have in the original syllabus Hilchos Nachlas was there, but Rav Meisha's notion of a wheel with Smichus Das is absolutely contrary to everything that I'm saying. It's a concept that can't possibly exist. And I suspect that Rav Meisha didn't understand what a wheel was. Rav Meisha thought that a wheel was an inter vivos gift. And as long as we're on it, maybe you can help me. I saw this once in a textbook, and I can't find it anymore. It's when I was Nishva Hankadach teaching property. It was preparing to teach property. So it was a woodcut. It had a picture of a horse and wagon, and it had pallbearers bringing a coffin out of the manor house. And the text said that title in early common law passed when the lord of the manor was taken out of the manor house to the cemetery. That's the minute at which the heirs inherited. Now, I've spoken to people who are supposed to know something about the history of law, and nobody has, even been able to give me. I forget the woodcut. I don't need the woodcut. This was to me a mark. It's the moment of death. That's you, because you're a 20th century lawyer. But I found the mark in Isatova. To me, it was a revelation. They weren't Amoratsim, these people, in the early common law period. They knew a corpse couldn't devise property. So, of course, he had to be giving a matona michaim. So they created a legal fiction that he's alive until he leaves the manor house, that the will clicks in that little interim period, in that period where he's semi-alive, semi-dead, to borrow Rubarzai LaRose's phrase in a different context. At that point, he still has the koyach to be makne. And I took it for granted that if Ramesh is talking about a will, he thinks that a will works that way. That sometimes, somoch lemisa, a rega, somoch lemisa, like our nusraf, shoach ha-somoch lemisa. He thinks a will is supposed to be chal shoach ha-somoch. I can't prove this, but I think that Moshe took it for a dover portion. He couldn't believe that they were such fools or hamratzim to think that a corpse could convey property by means of a will. So if you have proper smichas das, so it's no worse than sitomta. All you need is smichas das, you can turn minig ha-soyach into sitomta. That's how I understood Moshe. But once you tell me that it passes after death, I know what you're talking about. Sitomta. Well, I'm not trying to explain the ones who think that Situmta held for Dover Shleibod Olam. That's such a crazy. But most people think that Situmta won't help for Dover Shleibod Olam. I talk about Rabbi Kivaker, and I talk about the Dvar Avram with regard to either Hefker Besdin or a Cotton. I understand exactly what they're saying. Each one's saying it in a different way. They're saying that Hefker Besdin knew about. Besdin has the koyach to yank off the tentacles. But to go and attach it to somebody else, that they don't have the koyach to do. They can't change reality. In terms of the ontological universe, there is nothing which attaches to the other person. And Chazal don't have the koyach to make it attached to the person. And please don't confuse me with the Ran and Nida, who says when Bez Nagodol is it adds a day to the month, that the Ves Tachodesh changes. That Sadegeis of HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mekayim. But they didn't tell the Ves to change. They can't tell the Ves to change. They're not Bailim on the physical universe. And what I think both the Dvar Avraham and Kvager in different ways are saying is that the power of Chazal was limited. He didn't give them this power to create new kinyonim by reattaching the suckers to the tentacles to somebody else. Now, I consider that just aleph base. The only question is, how do you express it? I can express it differently, the same way that I don't have to talk about magnetic fields. I find it more convenient to talk about magnetic fields and to use the language of metaphysics. If you're telling me it's a myth, so be it. If you want to tell me that it's real, so be it. I don't care which it is. So it's it seems to me that once you use this as a pedagogical tool, you can use it in one of two ways. You can use it either because you recognize that this is a kind of convenient shorthand, but it's a way of explaining a theory that isn't very apparent by any means. Once you use, it's convenient, like Kantian categories. We superimpose them upon reality for our convenience. It's a kind of a notion that we can superimpose upon reality because it makes it easier for us to understand. And the same thing that Kant said about all of his categories, he didn't think they were real. He's telling me that's what how the mind deals with. Otherwise, you go berserk, you become meshuga, you become neurotic because you can't understand any of this. Or if you want to tell me that it really exists in the Lomas Elyonim, perfectly okay with me. It's Kabbalistic language. Who says there's no Kabbalah in Halacha? If you talk about issues as a Nivra of Har Sinai, I don't know exactly what you mean. You can explain that phenomenologically. The Rebbeinu Shlomo said, from now on, there's going to be such a thing because I am decreeing it. It's all relationship, blah, blah, blah. Or you can speak about it as a real creation, a real ontological creation, which came at the time of Har Sinai, and that issues exists. People certainly talk that way all the time. Take your pick, but I think that explains the concepts, and it's the easiest way to put all of these concepts into a coherent theory. Otherwise, you're dealing with little bits and pieces that try to explain everyone separately.
Yes?